All right, we're back, continuing our discussion on psychological professionals in the courtroom. Psychology is a much less scientific and precise field than is generally appreciated by the public and by our courts. I say this based upon years of experience in the medical field. I've been on locked wards. I have, in certain past jobs, placed people on 5150 involuntary holds as a danger to self or others. I am sympathetic to the great difficulties faced by psychologists and psychiatrists in battling mental illness. But experience has taught me that their abilities to diagnose and treat are much more limited than is generally realized. The clinical psychologist and psychiatrist is not an expert on memory, yet their pronouncements have put people in jail, not just for cases of mishandled abuse, but also recovered memory. The notion that some people may repress memory of unpleasant events is surely legitimate, but the specific pronouncements made by the alleged experts in matters of memory can be ludicrous. In 1989, George Franklin's daughter told police that a recovered memory had revealed to her that her dad had been the murderer of a childhood friend. Franklin was convicted of murder on the strength of a clinical psychologist's testimony. The psychologist had spent a grand total of 4 hours interviewing the daughter, after which she assured the court that the recovered memories in question were valid. Franklin's conviction was eventually overturned. Further doubt was cast on the case when still more recovered memories had her daughter fingering dad for two other murders. For one, Franklin was known to be elsewhere, and anyway, DNA exonerated him. The court, however, relying as it did on a psychological expert, had compelled Franklin to spend 6 years and 7 months in jail for murder. Clinical psychology is not a science. It is imprecise. Its effectiveness depends a great deal on the insights and abilities of the practitioner. Psychiatry's purview is extraordinarily broad. Obtain the textbook that catalogs the mental disorders of man, and you will find something like 374 specific diagnoses. The book, The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, 4th edition, or DSM-4, runs 900 pages. Produced by the American Psychiatric Association, it is the product of task forces, committees, and work groups. The DSM-4 is a rather imprecise catalog. It does provide a billing code for the practitioner so that his treatment will be compensated. Codes are provided, in fact, for virtually the whole range of human behavior. Examples include coffee nerves, bad coffee nerves, and inability to sleep after drinking too much coffee. It may come as a surprise to you, dear listener, that Starbucks has apparently been fueling a national surge of mental illness. But everything is mental illness per the DSM-4. Shyness has been relabeled Asperger's disorder. Snobbery can be redefined as a subset of the antisocial personality. Heck, even clumsiness has a number. This all may seem rather whimsical until an attorney shows up in a court with a DSM-4 tucked under his arm. You see, a psychological diagnosis can be used to obtain compensation on a claim of disability. One may argue, as one person did, that dismissal for groping females at work constituted discrimination for a disability, his mental illness, as listed in the DSM-4. Now, that guy lost, apparently, but this is hardly just a theoretical concern in the United States with its 900,000 lawyers and law schools that generate 40,000 hungry young graduates every year. In criminal cases, the misuse of the DSM is of even greater concern to us all. California voters moved against the diminished capacity defense in 1982. Before that, ex-San Francisco supervisor Dan White had gotten just 6 years in prison for murdering Mayor Moscone and Supervisor Melk. White's attorneys found a psychiatrist to claim that White suffered from depression. While it was never stated that White was a murderer because he ate Twinkies, it was alleged that he carried a diagnosis right out of the DSM, depression. That, somehow, lessened his crime. It may seem unlikely to you that lawyers and courts paw through hundreds of diagnoses in the DSM-4 to locate a label to place upon their client for the benefit of a jury, but our legal correspondent, Stuart Gardner, has witnessed something very much along those lines. Here now to discuss the interface of psychiatry and the courts is Stuart Gardner. Now, I know from talking to you that you have actually witnessed the DSM-4 being used, and I wanted you to talk about it.
Sure. I was working, and I had an LPS case, which is a conservatorship case. Somebody had been involuntarily committed in a state mental hospital.
Okay.
And I was given the task of attempting to get them out of the mental hospital to try to find them competent and able to take care of food, shelter, and clothing. I was the one who was in charge of taking care of this, but I was also being supervised. And one of the very first things we do, because I don't know anything about psychology, because they give you the DSM-4. I'm a lawyer. I'm not a psychologist. But I thought it was extremely ironic that the first thing they did was they gave me the DSM-4.
And said what? Here, find something?
Well, no, you have a diagnosis and you have the medical reports from the psychologist, but this guy was paranoid schizophrenic. So the first thing you do is you read the DSM-4 and paranoid schizophrenia so that you can learn a little about the disease.
Well, Stuart, I don't think I would have a beef with the use of the DSM-4 to try and understand, you as a layperson, even though you're a legal representative,
yep,
what that means to have that diagnosis and et cetera. So I don't think that is misuse of the book necessarily.
But, that's the starting point. Then you use everything in there as ammunition to try to help this person out of their conservatorship. So you end up using it as a weapon.
Well, I think the big concern we have on this show is its use as a weapon by defense attorneys in criminal cases, in the case of someone who's committed some terrible crime, to claim that because he's, quote, obsessive compulsive, unquote, or any of the other myriad listings in the DSM, 374, I believe there are, that he's somehow less responsible for his actions. This, clearly, is misuse of the book.
You may think that it's not appropriate for defense attorneys to use it, but it is an expert manual. It's what people rely upon in the field. And
it is a cookbook that allows you to take in Chinese menu style, one from column A, or say 3 out of the 5 criteria from column A, 5 out of the 7 criteria from column B, with features that include X, Y, and Z among several possibilities. So it's a very imprecise tool, not to say that in many cases that there is not a valid diagnosis for mental illness. Mental illness is a real thing. And I wouldn't say that in all cases that it's, you know, that it is frivolously being misused.
The simple truth of the matter is you use that as a starting point, and then you find one of your 374 diagnoses given by medical professionals, and you run with it. That is what a defense attorney does. They look at the best possible defense, and they try to help their person out to the best possible extent. And if you're coming in here to attack the legal profession because we rely upon the medical expert's advice, that's kind of silly, because defense attorneys will always try to find the best defense.
The fact that defense attorneys will always do it doesn't mean that it makes a great deal of sense once you have correctly assessed that, again, let me repeat, the American Psychiatric Association's own words, determining whether an individual meets a specified legal standard, e.g. for competence, criminal responsibility, or disability, additional information is usually required.
Yeah, like a diagnosis from an expert to back up the DSM-4, then you read the DSM-4 to try to get your guy out.
Well, that's just it. It's easy to understand that if your mission in life is to get the guy off, and this is one tool you can use to get the guy off, well, by God, lawyers, seems like they're all going to use it.
Of course they're going to use it. And the lawyers take advantage of what these psychologists have invented.
Let's return to Dan White. White got a light sentence because the jury bought his alleged impairment. He was depressed, it was said, and thus somehow not as responsible as he might have been for the twin murders. His conviction was for manslaughter, which in essence is the term used for accidental killings. Dan White got a DSM label pinned to him by a psychiatrist. Depression. That got him held to something less than premeditated murder, despite the fact that he concealed his pistol from the metal detectors, that he brought extra bullets, that he shot Moscone only after the mayor refused to give him back his job, and despite the fact that he then delivered extra shots to finish off both victims. From a legal standpoint, Dan White was sane. His actions revealed that he knew what he was doing was wrong and had to plan his crimes carefully. But psychiatric testimony was brought in to fuzzy his level of responsibility, and it worked. In 1843, the McNaughton case established that if a defendant did not appreciate that what he was doing was wrong, then he's not accountable for his crimes, like a normal person. Since that time, temporary insanity has been much favored by lawyers. If that won't seem to fly, then it's important to point out to the court that various psychological conditions explain why someone acted as he did. This was done in the Kerry Stainer trial. Last month, his jury was told by a psychiatrist that he is a serial killer because he is obsessed with Bigfoot. His interpretation of ink blots was unusual, they were told. A neuroscientist explained to the court that a brain scan reminded him of that of schizophrenics, even though no one has ever suggested that Stainer carries that diagnosis. Joining us to discuss another terrible case of mass murder and efforts of neuroscientists to muddy the waters for a jury is Andy Keough. Andy was involved as a witness in the case of Eric Leonard, who in 1991 killed three people in Sacramento on consecutive weeks. Now, Andy, my understanding is that according to the authorities, according to the people the courts were listening to, psychiatric personnel, Eric Leonard, the perpetrator, had a seizure disorder, and you and other witnesses and everyone else in the courtroom were then expected to work around this supposed disorder for the duration of the trial.
That's right. Eric Leonard was believed to be epileptic, and for that reason, every 20 minutes, proceedings were stopped in the middle of questioning, regardless of who the witness was and who was on the stand, so that Mr. Leonard could be given a break and checked to be able to tell the status of his disorder, see if he was in danger of having a seizure. His blood pressure was checked.
So this trial lasted about how long?
4 years, I believe it went on.
So, Andy, that was 4 years start to finish for the whole proceeding.
Or so, I believe. I'm not quite certain. I know that I had to come back a couple times over a two-year period to testify. Usually a week's worth of days at a time.
So you definitely witnessed like a week at a crack of this trial in action as it was proceeding along. And during that time, every 20 minutes, a nurse would come out, take his blood pressure, a doctor would come out and ask him if he needed medicine, he'd be given a drink of water, etc.
Or they would take him into the chambers in the back in a darkened room and let him relax so that he didn't have a seizure.
Did he ever have a seizure?
Not any while I was there, and definitely not any that I heard of.
How long did these breaks take?
20 or 30 minutes apiece.
So the proceedings were halved by the fact that every 20 minutes they broke for 20 to 30 minutes.
Yes, they were. And in fact, there were some days that the proceedings were stopped entirely, and everyone was sent home to come back and continue the next day because he was supposedly at higher risk of having a seizure, and therefore everything was stopped and put on hold.
It's easy to understand that people in the court of law are not medical personnel, and that they might not know whether this was legitimate or not. Andy, what was your and other people in the courtroom's impression about this as they watched this unfold time after time?
Even as a lay person, I mean, I think everyone in the room, from the prosecuting attorneys to just the observers, saw it as nothing but theater and a farce, but no recourse.
It stopped on schedule every 20 minutes.
Every 20 minutes.
But ultimately, what was the outcome in the trial?
Well, he was found guilty on many different charges beyond just the murders of all six people involved.
Which made it special circumstances and made him eligible for the death penalty.
Yes, and they did hold separate proceedings for that afterward.
And if I'm not mistaken, he is currently on death row at San Quentin.
As far as I know at this point, yes.
So it would appear then that perhaps the jury, if I'm sure you're representative of people in the courtroom, thinking that this theater that was going on of this 20-minute stoppage for supposed seizures, one would assume they didn't buy it either.
No, I would say there was no sale.
In the end, Leonard's defense based upon some sort of seizure disorder didn't work. But you have to wonder how such a lame medical defense could be offered in the first place. We asked physician Sean O'Neill to comment on that. Now, would you agree with me that most physicians that you speak to on issues like this pretty much agree with the lay public that the use of insanity defense is a little bit out of control?
I don't think there's any doubt about it. The people who are truly insane are obvious. They are you know, when they're not on their medication, there's no doubt in anyone's mind that they are incapable of making a rational decision. And it doesn't take a battery of psychiatrists or psychologists or even lawyers to convince a jury or anyone else in the public. You know, the people that you see walking down the main street, swatting at their head and talking to lampposts, wearing clothes that they haven't changed in 6 months, those people are crazy. They're insane. Someone well-dressed who premeditates a crime, I'm not buying that one. I think the lay public feels the same way. I think the bottom line is, so what? It really doesn't matter if he's got athlete's foot or dirty fingernails in terms of whether he was capable of knowing whether it's right or wrong, and he was capable of a premeditated attack. That's the bottom line. Was it a premeditated attack? Yes. Well known, well documented. Was he capable of distinguishing between the right and wrong? Yes, no question. What's left? We really don't care if he's got a caffeine addiction, or if he's got a speed addiction, or if he's addicted to adrenaline or bad novels.
But that is the point. Perhaps we should not care. But juries seem to care. Courtrooms seem to care. Judges seem to care. And defense attorneys, most particularly, very much seem to care.
The unfortunate aspect is that there are valid uses of psychiatry, and there are valid uses for the understanding of it. What we're seeing here is defense attorneys who are perverting a poorly understood science and are trotting out things that are very impressive to a jury because they have long names and they're pretty, and we have, society has been conditioned to believe that if it comes in a pretty package and it looks scientific, then it must be scientific.
Let us return to what we were saying earlier. Prominent cases like the McMartin preschool fiasco, George Franklin's murder conviction on recovered memory, and Carrie Stainer's defense based upon a Bigfoot obsession show that psychiatric professionals simply do not speak with the authority that is claimed for them. Such defenses often fail, as the Leonard case illustrated. But neuropsychiatric testimony must be labeled charlatanism when it is that. And perhaps it's time to charge those making outrageous claims with fraud. It's not enough to introduce other experts to counter ridiculous arguments. They should not be allowed in the first place. We would not accept an astrologer telling a court that a defendant must be not guilty because he has Saturn in his Pisces. Neither should someone be allowed to present Rorschach test results. Studies show they have limited value in diagnosis and none in explaining someone's actions. When a psychologist offers the court a Minnesota multiphasic personality index to prove a point, he's wasting the court's time. Studies show that they change in as little as 2 weeks in any given individual. Such tests are definitely not predictive. Courts have to realize that ordering extensive psychological testing on defendants may have little or nothing meaningful to contribute to our understanding of the person, let alone modifier treatment. There is no treatment, for example, for serial murderers. Whether he is clinically insane is irrelevant compared to whether he is legally insane. To plot out the required steps that any serial killer needs marks him as legally sane. He knows what he is doing is wrong. He conceals what he is up to. It seems to me that since the condition is not fixable, it makes little sense to house one in a mental hospital over a prison. What's the difference? The most important thing is that he never gets out again. A serial killer may be mentally ill in many senses, but this is irrelevant under the circumstances. He is legally sane. It's time to eliminate not guilty by reason of insanity. Guilty but insane makes more sense. Temporary insanity must be modified or eliminated. Psychiatrists and clinical psychologists have virtually no special insights into matters of mental illness as they bear upon American courtrooms. They cannot tell us why someone does something. They cannot tell us what someone will do in the future. Then it's time for the public to get aroused and to limit the practice. When it comes to the psychiatric professions, self-appointed role as the only people who can judge matters of the mind and mental illness, it is time for other physicians, nurses, experimental psychologists, and healthcare professionals to speak up and point out what the lay public has long suspected. The emperor has no clothes. For further reading on this subject, we recommend Michael Shermer's book, Why People Believe Weird Things, as well as Margaret Hagen's Horrors of the Court. It's especially good on the subject of what happened to George Franklin. For the McMartin preschool case, we'd recommend some further study on the web at religioustolerance.org, which has an excellent summary of that fiasco. We'd like to thank our guests today, Cosmo Garvin of the Sacramento News and Review, Dr. Sean O'Neill, our good friend of the law profession, Stuart Gardner, and Andy Keough, who shared with us his unfortunate experiences involved in the Leonard murder case. You have been listening to Radio Parallax. We are about out of time. We look forward to seeing you again next Thursday at 5 o'clock. In closing, I would like to go to someone that said much of what you heard earlier on this program far more eloquently than I could have. That would be songwriter Stephen Sondheim on the soundtrack for West Side Story with tongue firmly planted in cheek. Let us now go out with Officer Krupke.
Kindly Sergeant Krupke, you gotta understand, it's just our bringing up key that gets us out of hand. Our mothers all are junkies, our fathers all are drunks. Golly Moses, naturally we're punks.
Gee, Officer Krupke, we're very upset. We never had the love that every child ought to get. We ain't no delinquents, we're misunderstood. Deep down inside us there is good.
There is good,
there is good, there is good, there is untapped good. Like inside the voice of us is good.
That's a touching good story.
Let me tell it to the world.
Just tell it to the judge.
Come on, you judge. Dear kindly judge, your honor, my parents treat me rough. With all the marijuana, they won't give me a puff. They didn't want to have me, but somehow I was had. Leaping lizards, that's why I'm so bad.
Right, Officer Krupke, you're really a square. This boy don't need a judge, he needs an analyst's care. It's just his neurosis that ought to be curbed. He's psychologically disturbed.
I'm disturbed.
We're disturbed, we're disturbed, we're the most disturbed. Like we're psychologically disturbed.
Hear ye, hear ye. In the opinion of this court, this child is depraved on account of he ain't had a normal home.
Hey, I'm depraved on account I'm deprived.
So take him to a head shrinker.
Come on, you dumb brother.
My father is a bastard. My ma's an SOB. My grandpa's always plastered. My grandma pushes tea. My sister wears a mustache. My brother wears a dress. Goodness gracious, that's why I'm a mess.
Yes, Officer Krupke, you're really a slob. This boy don't need a doctor, just a good honest job. Society's played him a terrible trick. And sociologically he's sick.
I am sick.
We are sick. In my opinion, this child does not need to have his head shrunk at all. Juvenile delinquency is purely a social disease.
Hey, I got a social disease.
So take him to a social worker.
Dear kindly social worker, they say go earn some dough, like be a soda jerker, which means like be a schmo. It's not I'm anti-social, I'm only anti-work. Glory Oski, that's why I'm a jerk.
Hey, Officer Krupke, you've done it again. This boy don't need a job, he needs a year in the pen. It ain't just a question of misunderstood. Deep down inside him, he's no good.
I'm no good.
We're no good, we're no good, we're no earthly good. Like the best of us is no good.
damn good.
The trouble is he's lazy. The trouble is he drinks.
The trouble is he's crazy.
The trouble is he stinks.
The trouble is he's growing. The trouble is he's grown.
Crumpy, we got troubles of our own. Gee, Officer Crumpy, we're down on our knees. Cause no one wants a fellow with a social disease. Gee, Officer Crumpy.